But anyway, I'd really like to take this opportunity to try to explain a little bit to you about what we're interested in and the models that we're using and the questions that we're trying to address. And I think probably for most of this, if I have the these lights out and those lights on, I'll be okay. And then I'll, yeah,
if
maybe
you want, just holler and I'll run and turn everything down for you.
Okay. And also, if you want to ask me any questions, please feel free at any point in time. That doesn't bother me at all. So, I'd like to start out, you know, the experimental biologists generally, you know, need more than, you know, one brain and two hands in order to get anything accomplished. And so we rely on people in our laboratories to essentially do the work that we then go around and talk about. So I want to start out by just acknowledging the people who did most of the work that I'm going to talk about today. And that's a postdoctoral fellow in my lab, Gefei Zhang, and a graduate student, Sarah Taylor. And again, there's a few other people who contributed, and I'll try to remember to mention them along the way, but most of what I'm going to talk about is the result of these the work of these two talented individuals. So we're interested in how the body makes a blood vessel. And we've been thinking about this for a while, and we are focusing our interest in trying to understand how you go from this simple tube here that arises through the process of vasculogenesis to this complex network. And I think that many of you here have different approaches to trying to understand the same problem. And so what we've been thinking about the last couple of years is what's actually going on at the cellular level as this structure forms. And we know that there are a number of different cellular processes. One of the things that happens is that the cells are undergoing division. And this is probably all that my talk will have in common with the last speaker's talk. We both agree that cell division is very important in biological processes, and it certainly is important in forming this, what we call a primitive vascular network. And we also know, of course, that migration and the movements that lead to what we call sprouting angiogenesis and then the fusion of the ensuing sprouts are also important for elaborating this network. So what happens is these processes are important to initially form this pattern, and then subsequently there are remodeling steps that involve input from blood flow parameters and from the mural cells, pericytes, and smooth muscle cells. However, the initial pattern is largely a result of these types of cellular processes. I think I'm going to switch to the stick. So, okay. It's largely a result of these types of cellular processes. So they're going on at the same time. And so we've been trying to understand how are these processes integrated as this vasculature is forming. Now, one of the ways that this can happen is through the input of signaling pathways that basically affect both cellular processes at the same time. And one of these pathways that we've already heard quite a bit about and that we'll talk a little bit more about today is the VEGF pathway. And basically, without going through a lot of the details, which really aren't important for this talk, you have a ligand, you have receptor tyrosine kinases. There's two of them that are especially important for VEGF-A, and this is the same molecule that you just heard a lot about from Louisa this morning. And the effect of the interaction of this ligand with these receptors is to modulate both cell division, cell migration, and cell survival and permeability, as we heard about this morning. Primarily during development, which is where we focus our research interest in trying to understand how these vessels first form during embryogenesis, primarily during development, signaling through the flick receptor receptor, which is also called VEGFR2, leads to positive effects on cell division, migration, and survival. And in work that I'm not going to have time to talk about today, we've looked at the effects of this pathway and the effects of this particular receptor, which is also called VEGFR1. And we've shown that under in the developmental scenario that this receptor acts as a negative regulator of cell division and as a positive regulator of migration. And I can go into more detail in the question and answer period if you want to know more about that. But the point I'm trying to make with this slide is that you do have a signal input that can potentially coordinate these processes. However, for a while, we thought that this really probably isn't enough, that there's probably, for things to really work right, you know, you've got to have this input. But we know, and again, Louisa sort of alluded to this, we know that once you go through the receptor and you move down into these signaling pathways that are downstream, like P38 and AKT that she mentioned this morning, you know, you diverge. And so, but by and large, the things that affect division downstream are not the same things that affect migration. So we think that there's a number of different places where these inputs are probably cross-talking with each other in some way. And so what we've been trying to figure out is what's going on here, okay? You know, first of all, is this happening? Second of all, how is this happening, both at the level of the cell and at the level of the pathways? And so I'm going to tell you about what we found out just in the last couple of years in terms of what's going on here.
Yes, so as soon as you have two receptors to VGF, so VGF can bind to FSK1 or FSC1?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's two receptors, and most endothelial cells have both receptors, okay? And it can bind, and it actually has a higher affinity for this receptor than for this receptor. To be very simple about it, we believe developmentally that this receptor, by virtue of a soluble form that's made, is acting as a sink. So it acts as a competitive inhibitor for the ligand to go down this pathway. But that has different effects on different cellular processes. Yes.
So what happens to the cell if you have a flux of VEGF that saturates all the both receptors?
What happens?
Mm-hmm. It increases division or decreases division?
It basically what happens is if you the amount of division is linked to how much of this receptor is occupied. Okay. And again, we believe that this receptor is acting as a ligand, as a competitive inhibitor, or as a ligand sink. So it's not, at least developmentally, I want to preface that, because there are certainly scenarios in pathophysiological situations where it appears that signaling through this receptor is important. But in our models, we don't see the crosstalk of the signaling pathways between these different receptors. Okay, so when you have, what happens is you're going to be dividing more as you put more VEGF on. Now, one thing that maybe, I'll use the same graph here that the previous speaker used. So remember I mentioned this morning that if you look at migration in response to VEGF by endothelial cells, it's a bell curve, okay? But cell division is not a bell curve, okay? Cell division is basically a direct relationship, okay?
Yeah, but doesn't it saturate?
Yeah, there comes a point.
Yes, it saturates when you don't have any more receptors to be.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, this goes down much sooner than the receptor saturates.
And just for definitional purposes, you've chosen to use the word migration. Do you mean motility or do you mean migration? Because to me, migration means you've got a directed motility. Are you just using it in the sense that you're engaging the motile machinery, or are you also saying that because it's kind of two different things to me. Migration is motility plus a destination. Is that what you want it to be?
Yeah, because what we when we measured migration, so you know, we did some genetic studies that have been published, so I'm not going to go through them. But basically, we were measuring, you know, okay, you have something, you have a sprout that's come out, and then, you know, how efficiently does it go along a vector and move in a certain direction? I mean, the direction that it sets up.
Mm-hmm.
But we weren't looking at sort of just wiggling around. We were looking at going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So you would call that migration, right?
I would call it highly persistent motility. But it's not, there's a target. In other words, I'm really asking, you don't necessarily have a target in mind. I mean, you're not saying you have to go to this point in space or this secretion front for some cytokine or something. Okay, that's all I'm saying.
There's also another aspect. If you have a sprout and the cells are producing a protein, mm-hmm. it also pushes and effectively into migration of the sprout. Do you count that in? That's actually linked to subdivision.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so one of the things you can if you have more cell division, that can push the sprout out. But the data that we got said that in a situation where you didn't have this receptor, you had more cell division, but you had less migration.
Yeah, I don't think, we can argue about it, but I don't think cell division has anything to do with sprouting. Now, we can argue about that. It's your talk, but you know, I don't see. I mean, when I look at embryos, I don't see how it could possibly have anything to do with it on that length scale and a tiny little thing like that.
So maybe some of the data will address that as we move along. Okay, so basically we have this pathway, but we think that there might be other places where things crosstalk, and so we set out to sort of ask a couple of very basic questions, and the questions were: does the morphogenetic program or morphogenetic cues modulate the cell cycle program as these vessels are developing? So now we're talking exclusively about the target cell being endothelial cells. Okay, so granted, you know, a mature vessel has other things going on, but we're only talking about endothelial cells. And then conversely, does the cell cycle program modulate the morphogenetic program? Okay? And so the data that I'm going to present to you today, I hope will at least go partway to convincing you what we think is that the morphogenetic program does influence the cell cycle, and we think that it influences it in two ways. We think that it influences the rate of cell division, and we think that it also influences the orientation of cell division. And I am not going to have time to talk about our very preliminary work, but we've started to take a stab at this, and our very preliminary data suggests that, in fact, maybe it's a one-way street and that the cell cycle program really doesn't impinge that directly on the morphogenetic program. And again, I'd be glad to discuss this afterwards, but I'm not going to present the data. It's very preliminary in any case. Okay, so now we have our question set up, so how are we going to test this? And so we use a number of different models in my laboratory, but one model that we've used quite consistently over the years and that's been extremely useful.
Yeah, before you go, when you say morphogenetic program, what do you think that is?
Well, I'm gonna get a little bit more specific as we go along. So the fact of the matter is that we don't really know explicitly what it is. But what I'm saying is that the cells, the endothelial cells, have a morphogenetic context. They know where they are in terms of a vessel, in terms of whether are they in a sprout, are they near a sprout, are they, you know, they're coordinating these parameters of cell division based on location. That's what I'm meaning to say. Okay. So the model that we use takes advantage of the fact that if you take mouse embryonic stem cells and you induce them to differentiate in vitro, you can form these structures called embryoid bodies. And I don't know if Celeste Simon went through this model. She's used it extensively as well. What we do is, after about 3 days, we can take these partially differentiated structures and put them back, reattach them back to a dish. And over the ensuing several days, so after about a week, we have what is a very complex pseudo-biological system, I should say. So if you look through the microscope, what you see with a phase contrast lens is a whole bunch of cells. So there's a lot of different cells, and we know from experiments that we and others have done, there's a number of different cell types, including a layer of cells called endoderm that actually produce VEGF that's required for the formation of blood vessels. Okay, so we have an endogenous source of this very important ligand and likely a lot of other important signals. If we now stain with PCAM, which is a vascular marker, we see this very beautiful primitive vascular plexus that's formed. So this basically occurs, you know, with very little manipulation on our part. We basically just take away something that prevents these cells from differentiating and going through this program. Okay? So a couple of years ago, we became interested in trying to sort of move to the next level, and inspired by Charlie and his work, we really wanted to be able to do live imaging. And so what we did is we took green fluorescent protein and built it into a construct with a vascular promoter, and then took this gene and put it into these embryonic stem cells before they differentiated, and basically got sublines of cells that we could then differentiate. And as they differentiated, they expressed green fluorescent protein only in the developing blood vessels. Okay? So this then allowed us to actually follow these processes that we were interested in. And so this is an example of one of the movies. So what we would then do is we would image these cultures over time and acquire the images and then put them together. So if I can find my... So what I'm going to show you now is a short movie in which initially you're going to see sprouting from here, sprouting from here, and at the end of the sequence they'll come together and fuse here, and about a third of the way in, you're also going to see a cell division right up in there. So here we go. Here's the sprout starting. There's the cells dividing. Here's the sprout coming up from the bottom. And then you see at the end of the sequence, the fusion has occurred.
That's lumen formed at that stage?
Probably in this particular, in this part of the structure, I don't see a lumen. I'm sure there isn't one here yet. However, if you look back in here, you can see that there's a faint outline, so I'm pretty sure that this is a lumen. We definitely see lumens. There's some other pictures I'll show you in a few minutes that I think show this more clearly. And the other thing we've done more recently is we've done a confocal Z series through some vessels, and you can clearly see a lumen.
And is the lumen full of fluid or extracellular patients?
Well, the lumen is, whether it's full of fluid or not, I don't know. There are some cells in there, because this differentiation program also leads to the formation of primitive hematopoietic cells. So there are some primitive hematopoietic cells within the lumen. But one important thing to know is that there's no flow in this model. Okay? So there's really, so whatever we're looking at is happening in the absence of flow, and that's going to become important.
In an avian embryo, we've looked, and we don't find anything interesting inside the little incipient lumens. I mean, we don't see VEGF. I'm sorry, we don't see fibronectin or collagen or lamin. They have fluid in them, and it's... Yeah.
Uh-huh.
What's the size of the cell in this picture?
It's about where it's real thin there, the thinnest part of that. That's probably about 5 or 6 micrometers. Right in there, yeah.
Yeah, and you saw the cells round up and divide, right? So, you know, this, like this here, like something like this is in this extension is probably a cell. This is maybe one cell or maybe two cells, something
I
like
bet
that.
You, so this is, I'm just going to guess that there's a nucleus here. And a good way to admit when you're looking at these is to think of a nucleus as about 10 micrometers long. That's a good gauge.
So the thing that we can't see with this, and you'll see with some of the stains that we have later on, it'll be more clear. The thing you can't see with this is the outline of individual cells, and that's because this is green fluorescent protein, and unattached to anything else is basically cytoplasmic. So what you see here is a cytoplasm. In some of the frames, we can actually see you know, dark areas is probably where the nucleus is excluding the signal. But we can't actually see the cell borders. We're hoping to be able to do that in the near future. Okay, so this was pretty, so we were pretty happy with this, and we thought that this would allow us to address some of the questions that we wanted to ask. And so the first question that we wanted to ask was, you saw the cell division here. So we wanted to know whether there was a discontinuity in terms of where the cell divisions occurred. In other words, you know, did you have more cell divisions in some place than other places, or were all the cells sort of dividing, you know, just kind of as if they didn't care where they were? Now, the speaker this morning said that, you know, everybody knows that there's big differences in the cell division rates. But interestingly, you know, so it's one of these things where everybody thinks that that's the case, and there is some old data in the literature that suggests this, and some pretty good data, especially for tumor vessels. But there really hasn't been a systematic analysis of this done, especially with these modern tools. And so we thought that it was worth taking a look. And so basically, we just asked a very simple question. We said, okay, we're going to take these movies, and we're going to score the divisions, and we're going to put them into one of two categories. And the first category is what we call the sprout field. And the sprout field is this sprout right here, and this area, it probably goes a little bit deeper, that's near the sprout in the vessel. And before the sprout forms, it's the area where the sprout is going to form, okay? And when we calculated, you know, the average area of the sprout field, it was about 3 to 4% of the area. And then we said, okay, the primary vessel is everything else, which is 96 to 97% of the area. And then we just said, where do the cell divisions fall in terms of these categories? And it turned out that in the primary vessels, we had basically about 80% of the divisions, but we had over 20% of the divisions in the sprout field, which was only 3 to 4% of the area. So, and this is really not important for this talk. I should have blocked it out. I'm sorry. But anyway, the point is that you've basically got an enrichment of cells that are dividing, presumably have their cell cycle upregulated. They're traversing the cell cycle at a faster rate in the areas of active morphogenesis. Now, we believe, and others have data that is consistent with this, that the cell that's at the very edge of that sprout, the tip cell, is not actually dividing. So this increased cell division is definitely behind the leading edge. And you're right, it could act to push out the sprout. And, you know, that it's certainly theoretically possible. But in any case, there's a relationship here, okay? And so this is basically all I'm going to say about this. So our findings suggest that morphogenetic cues can modulate the endothelial cell cycle to impact morphogenesis. And we're in the process of thinking about what the signals might be and how this crosstalk actually occurs. In other words, what is it about being in an area of active morphogenesis that tells the cells to cycle faster than their neighbors that are in a more quiescent part of the vasculature? Okay. So the other question that we became interested in, another way that morphogenesis can impact on cell division, is by regulating the orientation of cell division. So we know from work in many models that cell divisions are often oriented relative to axes in the animal or axes in the tissue of interest. And these regulated, these oriented divisions are often regulated. In other words, there are some players and some pathways that have been found that actually mediate this regulation. In other models, the orientation and specifically oriented divisions that are asymmetric, which I think was mentioned here briefly, often segregate cellular components asymmetrically. And then this and also just the division orientation not going to go through all the details here, but basically a lot of these major players that we know are important in general and in other models were first identified in this very simple invertebrate system as being important for oriented asymmetric divisions. And that includes a whole set of proteins called PAR proteins, some other players, CDC42, I think we'll hear about that from George tomorrow, and a number of other components. This work has been extended, and we also know that cell divisions and epithelial sheets are oriented. So if your cells and you're in an epithelial sheet, okay, that means you're stuck together, and you know where your apical side is, and you know where your basolateral side is, and you also know where you are in this plane. And sometimes divisions occur that actually give rise to cells that leave the plane and start new structures or have different cell fates. And a recent paper that was published by Elaine Fuchs' lab last year nicely showed that in developing mouse skin, you normally have divisions that allow for new epithelial layers to form and for stratification that's important in skin development, and that when you do various genetic perturbations, you mess this up. And they showed how you can visualize this by seeing that in wild type, most of the divisions were, so I think they were scoring the spindles here, were basically this, the spindles were this way, so the cells were dividing this way and making a new layer, whereas a few would go this way. And then when they did these genetic manipulations, they got a randomization of that oriented type of division. Okay, so we asked, is endothelial cell division oriented? And we thought about this like pretty simply. We said, well, you know, there's a lot of things that could possibly happen, but one thing that might be very simple that could happen is that if you have a cell and you have, this is the long axis of a blood vessel, and if it divides this way, you might effectively lengthen the cell. And if it divides this way, you might basically make the cell have a bigger diameter. So this is the model. And this is, again, about as sophisticated as our models get. You basically start out with a blood vessel. And if you have a number of divisions in which the cleavage plane, which is this line right here, going through here, is perpendicular to the long axis of the vessel, you effectively would make a longer vessel. And if you have a number of parallel divisions, in terms of this is now the cleavage plane and it's parallel to the vessel long axis, you would end up with a vessel, actually thicker is probably not quite right, a vessel with a bigger diameter.
Larger diameter,
thank you. So we said, okay, well, let's see if this might be happening. And so, to finish this off, you can think of times and places in development where both processes might be important. So we're not going to go through all these details, but this is basically a cutaway of about a mid-gestation embryo from a recent review. And the point I wanted to make is that you've got big vessels like the dorsal aorta, which I'm sure you heard about from Charlie, and these vessels are growing in terms of having a larger diameter over time. Whereas other vessels, such as these inner cemitic vessels, and these are the same vessels that Louisa was showing you this morning as being messed up in those mutants, they're effectively, they start here and pretty quickly they have to get up to here. So they're probably in a program where they're getting longer and rather than getting wider. And in fact, although there's not anything in the recent literature at all that even begins to address this question that I could find, I should say, there's a very interesting paper that was published in 1939 by Clark and Clark. And what they did is they had a number of different models, including they did this in rabbit ears and they did this in some amphibians, where they would basically just sit and watch blood vessels forming, and then they would draw pictures because they didn't have cameras to take pictures at the time. And here's actually a vessel, and here's a cell, and you can daughter cells, and these are the minutes. They were counting, you know, the minutes that this was happening. So this, you know, this is pretty amazing. But you know, again, very little has been done in terms of addressing this since then. So we said, okay, let's see what we can do. So what we did is we made another version of this, these reporters that I mentioned earlier. And in this case, what we did is we did the same sort of setup, but now what we did is we took that GFP and we linked it to a histone H2B protein. And histone H2B goes to the DNA, and it basically binds the DNA, and it stays there. So it allows you to visualize the DNA in the cell. So we're not going to now see the whole cell. We're just going to see these little dots that are nuclei. And so we put this construct in, and whoops. And we were able to, again, obtain sublines in which the now you're seeing nuclear GFP here. This is an overlay of that same, this is the same field with vascular marker, and this is the overlay. So you can see there's a really nice concordance there. So now what we're going to do is we're going to take the top part of this image here, and we're going to look at what we see when we make a movie. So this is basically going to be a shorter sequence than what you saw before, but you're going to see a nice cell division. And I think it happens in the middle here about halfway through. So, there we go. Ha! Okay? And then you have the two daughter nuclei, and this goes on for just a little bit longer. So basically, what we did is we made a bunch of movies like this, and we made pretty short movies so that after we finished, we could stain with the PCAM, and we could actually very rigorously define where the vessel long axis was. And then we went in, as those cells right at the point where they were dividing and those chromosomes were pulling apart, we just measured the angle there. And so what we did is measured a whole bunch of angles, okay, relative to the vessel long axis. And what we found, actually somewhat surprisingly, since remember there's no flow in this system, is that there really was a strong orientation towards perpendicular cleavage plane. So that's shown here in this little diagram down here. So basically, almost 60% of the divisions that we scored were within 10 degrees of perpendicular. And if you combine the first 20 degrees here, it was basically over three quarters of them. And very few of the divisions were sort of off the perpendicular. And this is just another way of showing the same data, very similar to what was in the Fuchs paper, except we don't have spindle markers, so we're actually measuring the cleavage plane, not the where the spindles are. So in this case, this is actually showing that the cleavage plane was perpendicular to the vessel long axis. So again, in a flow-independent system, this is the level of regulated orientation. So the next thing that we wanted to know, so okay, if the cells are dividing this way, in order for the divisions to have an effect on morphogenesis, the daughter cells would need to sort of maintain the spatial relationships. So in other words, if you have a division like this, and then the daughter cells immediately go like this or like this, then you know it doesn't really matter, does it? So we wanted to know what happened to daughter cells. So what we did is we took the same movies and we followed daughter nuclei. So we got three different things that happened depending on the division. So the first thing that happened, and this happened by far the majority of the time, the first thing was that the majority of the divisions were the cleavage plane was perpendicular to the vessel long axis. And when we followed the daughter cells out for an hour or sometimes more than an hour, in all the times that we could score them, sometimes we lost them, but when we could score them, we could see that they maintained their relationships. And so they always stayed in this relationship. And here you see the traces. So this is the original daughter cells at the time of division, or the daughter nuclei, I should say, because that's what we're monitoring. And this is the path, the tracking path that they take between then and the end of the movie. Yeah?
Is there a simple in this direction?
That's possible. However, we do have situations where we have, and I'll show you some later on, where we have vessels that are thin, where we basically have the divisions occurring not that way. Okay. So the next thing that we looked at is when the divisions do occur in a parallel fashion. And what happened in this case is we got two results. It turned out that about 70% of the time, when the divisions occurred parallel, the daughter cells maintained that relationship so that at the end of, again, about an hour, they were still parallel and they were effectively the daughter cells would be making for a larger diameter. However, about 30% of the time, in this scenario only, did we see a realignment. So if there was a parallel division and then we saw that at the end of a period of time, the daughter cells had realigned themselves that way. So there is a little bit of something like this happening, but over half of the time, this is the relationship that maintains. So that led us to conclude that daughter nuclei, by and large, do maintain the spatial relationship set up by the cleavage.
Is it true or not? Not every nucleus is, yes or no, every nucleus is labeled in this electroporation? You understand what I'm saying? So are there other cells there? Are there other endothelial cells there, but we can't see their nuclei because they're not GFP labeled?
In this particular subline, probably not 100% of the nuclei, but probably 95% of the nuclei.
Okay.
But there's a bunch of other nuclei here that are not labeled.
Yeah,
right?
I understand that. That answers my question. Because it looks like they're near branch points a couple of times there, right? Yeah.
Right. Okay. So the next thing that we wanted to know was, in areas of active morphogenesis, and we were thinking about sprouting, what's happening to the orientation of the cleavage plane in these particular situations? And so in order to test this, we actually couldn't use these cells because it was difficult to figure out exactly where a sprout was because it's often not more than a process or a single cell. And so what we did is, just for this one experiment, we went back to our original cytoplasmic GFP-labeled endothelial cells because, you know, even though we can't follow the daughter cells out very far, we can see the divisions and we can follow them for some period of time. And so what we did now is we said, okay, now we're going to look in sprouts and we're going to see, and near sprouts, and we're going to see how things are oriented. And what we found was that, first of all, we looked at a situation where you don't have a sprout there when the division occurs, but you have a sprout that forms subsequently, okay? So here's the parent cell, it's yellow, before it divides, the two daughter cells after they divide, and then you see subsequent to that, and this is time in minutes down here, you see a sprout forming. And what we see here is that the division occurs perpendicular, with the cleavage perpendicular to the parental axis, not to the future sprout axis. So that's diagrammed here. And this happened, again, we didn't have very many cases where we had divisions exactly where we could score them. So the numbers are small, but they were consistent. So in this case, we had two cases where we found this. And in both cases, the divisions were perpendicular to the parental long axis, even though the sprout subsequently formed right near where the division occurred.
So are those two that formed, are they precursors to the lining of the sprout?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know what? I think in many cases, one of them at least is. But the problem with the cytoplasmic GFP is that when the cells round up, you can see them really well as distinct cells, but as soon as they stop, you know, finish their little thing, they kind of get back into the glob, and we can't.
Why don't you put on PCAM, fluorine estimated PCAM antibody?
Yeah, you know, that works, and you know it works, and I've been trying to get them to do that for like a long time, but even then, it doesn't, I don't think it gives us clear. And
it's not perfect, but it gives you, here's the body of the cell, and you can see some phyla, some phyla,
mm-hmm.
not real, real fine ones.
Mm-hmm.
You can purchase it, I think, already.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, I know, we've gotten it.
Oh,
no,
okay.
we've gotten it
oh,
to work, but it's, you know,
oh, yeah.
When sometimes there's a little bit of an energy of activation. But anyway, the fact remains is that we don't formally know what happens to these cells after a short period of time. But we'll know in a while. You know, we've got things set up to try to sort that out.
Tell me before I submit my next modeling grant.
So the next scenario that we looked at was when there's a division within the sprout field, but still in the parental vessel, when a sprout is already formed, okay? So now you have this, I don't know, this might be a little bit more mature than what we would call a real sprout, but there's a structure here, and here's the parental long vessel. And here you can see, again, a division that occurs with the cleavage plane perpendicular to the long axis of the parental vessel. So that just shows that here. And that happened in again, about 5 out of 5 cases that we could see. So even though the sprout is right here, these cells are obeying this axis and not this axis. So then the final thing that we looked at is when a division actually occurred within a sprout. And again, we didn't find a whole lot of these, about 5 or 6. But you can see here that once in a sprout, when we scored a division, it occurred perpendicular to the sprout axis. So
where's the tip?
The tip is right here.
So are you saying proliferation happened way behind?
Yeah.
Way behind the tip?
Well, maybe not way behind, but
I mean,
there's at least one cell, at least one, maybe two cells between the tip and this cell, which is dividing. This right here, this is actually at the base of the sprout, right? Because here's the parental vessel. So this is right at the base of the sprout.
Has it ever occurred here?
We've looked pretty hard, and it's hard to say. I mean, there are situations where it looks like it might occur even in the tip cell, but then, you know, we don't really know. So what we're doing here is, in a way, we're modeling, because we're taking something that's three-dimensional and we're pretending it's two-dimensional, right? And so in most cases where we thought we saw something in a tip cell, we couldn't be sure that, like, there was something else nearby, that maybe there was a connection there, and so it really wasn't a tip cell, but it was part of a thing that we couldn't quite follow in our plane. So one of the things I didn't explain properly is that the way that we set up this model, what we're looking at are pancakes, okay? So we do have three dimensionality. You know, these cells, these vessels are round, they have lumens, but we're very much flattened, you know, in this dimension, so that we essentially can image in a single focal plane and see most of what we want to see. Now, we have done Z-stacks to make sure that, you know, there isn't a whole lot going on that we're just completely obliterating in terms of what we're doing. And for certain things that we want to do in future, we will need to do Z-stacks. But at least for this, we're just looking in a single focal plane. Okay, so what we basically conclude from this is that endothelial cells divide in relation to a current vessel long axis. In other words, they don't anticipate that there's going to be a sprout here and make a division this way. However, once they're in a sprout, you know, even if they started out back here, they now obey the parameters of this vessel long axis. All right? So that kind of got us, you know, thinking about, okay, this is kind of neat. These cells are, you know, they know where they are. They know how they're responding to something. But this was happening in this model that I just explained to you. And so we wanted to see if this also was something that was happening in vivo. And so I want to just summarize here. So I just want to quickly go over this. Endothelial cell division is oriented perpendicular to the vessel long axis. The orientation is independent of blood flow. Daughter nuclei maintain spatial relationships, and it orients to the current vessel long axis. So now we want to look in vivo. And so what we decided to do was use the postnatal rodent retina as a model for vivo vessel development. Again, pretty much because you can see this three-dimensional process happening in a very flattened plane, and it's quite easy for imaging and for looking. So we basically took, in this case now, we're going to be looking at fixed images. We're not going to be looking at live imaging. And what we're going to do is we're going to stain with something called an isolectin to look at the blood vessels. And then we're going to stain with an antibody for something called phosphohistone H3. And what this does is it reacts with the DNA of mitotic cells. So we can basically look at mitotic nuclei. And so these are the types of confocal images that we can get. So this is a rat retinal blood vessel, and this is a cell that's in the process of dividing. Here's the anaphase chromosomes. And so again, what we're going to do now is measure this and this angle. Okay? And here's another example here. And so when we do this, we get a very similar result to what we got in our ES cell model, except it's, if anything, even more slanted towards the cleavage plane being in the perpendicular. Now, I want to point out that in this case, we do have blood flow ongoing in this developing vascular bed. So it's possible that the difference between what we saw in the ES model and what we see here is a result of the exposure to blood flow, but we don't know that formally. Okay, so now we're pretty sure that this is happening, but we don't really understand yet anything about how it's happening or what's regulating it. And so we wanted to start asking about signaling pathways that might impact the orientation of endothelial cell divisions. And we decided to start by asking about the effects of manipulating the VEGF signaling pathway. And again, we've already talked about this. And we reason that, again, because the input here affects a number of cellular processes, that it was likely that there might be some regulation at this level. And we also felt that we knew that perturbations of this pathway lead to vascular dysmorphogenesis. And you heard about some of this morning when Louisa was talking about the bigger vessels, when the soluble form of VEGF was around. And so, and again, we had done a genetic loss of function for VEGF, for FLT1 or VEGFR1, and essentially showed, and others had shown this as well, that what you see is what we call vascular dysmorphogenesis. So instead of getting these nice vessels, you're getting these endothelial sheets in this model. However, let me just turn the lights up for a second here. I won't do it for too long because I know we're getting late. That basically you've got these areas where you do see pretty nice looking vessels at the edge of these dysmorphogenic areas. So these are the areas. Okay. So these are the areas that we're going to be looking at and scoring. Okay. So now what we want to do is we want to ask. What happens to the orientation of cell division in these areas where we have basically perturbed VEGF signaling. Okay? And so we do this by, again, building the same construct now into cells that already are mutant for this receptor, and then we set up the same series of experiments. And what we find is relative to wild type, which is shown in light blue, that the orientation division is randomized in this genetic background. And again, if you look here, this is basically a little schematic of the wild type divisions, and these are the divisions in the FLT1 mutant background. So the elimination of FLT1, and again, in work that we and others have done that I won't go into, this essentially is a gain of function in VEGF signaling. You randomize the orientation of cell division. So we next wanted to know if we could rescue the dysmorphogenesis of FLT1, could we also rescue the randomization of division orientation? And again, I don't want to go into the genetic details of how we did this or why we did this, because it is a whole other story. But what we did do is, we took a transgene that was a version of the receptor, and we basically put it back into cells that were mutant for FLT1. This should be already missing FLT1, okay? And we had already shown that when we do this, we can rescue some of the defects, some of the phenotype of the FLT1 mutants. So now we're going to ask, how does this affect the orientation division? So here, again, we're looking with fixed cultures, and we've got PCAM now in green, and we've got this mitotic marker in red. Here's a nice wild-type division perpendicular to the long axis. Here's a flit mutant vessel where, again, the vessel isn't very big, but you see it being in parallel. And here are a couple of rescues. These are two different rescue lines, and again, we're not going to go into the details, but they look nicely rescued, and that's great. Thanks, Charlie. And if we now do the numbers, we can see that both of these lines pushed back the so this is the randomization, the purple, and now if we look at the rescues, we see that they nicely bring back the orientation to not completely to wild type levels, but close to wild type levels. So here we have wild type, here we have mutants, and here are the two rescues as well, in a different formulation. Okay, so.
So what would it mean if the rescue would not have taken place? I mean, what would you have concluded?
What we would have concluded is that the ability to rescue the dysmorphogenesis was not linked to the orientation, and that probably some other aspect of, so again, it's complicated, but what we're putting back is not exactly the whole receptor. It's a part of the receptor that we think does a lot of the things that happen developmentally, but it was possible that there were different parameters that were being affected there. It also is a proof that the randomization is linked to the mutation. Because when you go in and you rescue, you know, you start with mutant cells, and then you're literally putting back a single molecule genetically that now is rescuing that. So it doesn't tell you, you know, where in the pathway you are, but it tells you genetically that they're linked. Okay? So where this is basically where we're at. We think that both the rate and the orientation of endothelial cell division are regulated by morphogenetic cues. In other words, that endothelial cells do know where they are in the vessel. We think that the regulation of orientation is flow dependent, at least during the earliest stages of blood vessel formation before flow initiates. And we do see it in vivo in flow exposed vessels. And we also believe that our work shows that VEGF signaling can regulate division orientation. But of course, there's a huge black box between the VEGF signal and the output that we're reading. So the goal now is to sort of fill in what's in between and to try to really understand, what within the cell is actually regulating this process. And I think that one of the clues and one of the things that we're following up on is the idea that regulated or having division orientations regulated in this manner is usually a function in some way of the cells being polarized, of them knowing where they are relative to different axes, okay? And we know that endothelial cells are polarized, it was already discussed, they're polarized between their luminal side and their abluminal side. And we know that if you take endothelial cells and you expose them to flow, that they polarize along the flow vector, okay? And so what we think is that there's also a form of polarization here that's in the same vector as flow, but is flow independent, and that it's possible that some of the molecular mechanisms that regulate those other processes of polarization will also be involved in this effect. Okay, so again, Gefei Zhang and Sarah Taylor were crucial for all of the work. These are other people in my lab that have contributed. I want to mention a very important collaboration with Emmy Hartnett's lab. She's in the ophthalmology department at UNC, and we had never done anything with retinas before, and her and Jan McComb, a postdoc in her lab, were just incredibly helpful in allowing us to quickly make progress with our retinal studies. And we've gotten reagents from a host of wonderful colleagues, some of whom are named here. So very much.
They're being kind of, you know, not maybe stretch is a good word, but they know that this layer is spreading out over the dish, and they perceive that, and yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so one of the things that we're interested in is, you know, where are the receptors as the cells are dividing, and where is there a difference in where the receptors are, and or is there a difference in where the receptors are activated? So I think when we can sort that out, we'll have some answers to that. That's a good question. George?
I don't remember which, when the cells divide, I sort of thought it looked like your cells, when they divided, started migrating apart.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is where is the, if you know where the centrosome is it like on opposite sides, kind of like a mirror image, and they move in the direct, because usually cells move, I think, in the direction of where their centrosome is pointing. So I'm just wondering. It's just because the reason I bring this up is it's very interesting. It looked like your nuclei divided and they kind of pulled apart in many of your images. And so what we've found is that, for example, in tumor cells, we're doing movies of invasion. Cells are invading in this direction, they'll divide, and this guy, the guy that's going forward will keep going, but the guy that divided goes backwards.
Mm-hmm.
Very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Almost that always happens that way. It's not like they divide and keep going like this.
Typically,
it's like they divide and go like that.
Because the microtubule organizing center is used, I mean, like classically, traditionally, doggo wise, is always on the leading side of the nucleus.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
so when the daughter cells separate, then yeah, that's right. The MTOC is always pointing opposite. Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't have a centrosome marker in there yet, but you know,
really
that would be
that's
actually a great prediction that we can try to test.
I think something else falls out of this, which is even more intriguing, I think, and it has to do with Roland's question: is what if you could have a hypothesis, or what if so the cells that it's really cool the cells that you have that are near presumptive branch points or near branch points that engage in mitosis, okay? So they've spent a lot of metabolic energy releasing their adhesions and wrinkling up and making making microtubule spindles and pulling their daughter chromosomes apart and going through all this, right? It's expensive for a cell to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sort of rounded up and they're not spread and extended. And so they have a choice now. It's just as easy for them to go kind of in a different way than it is to go the way they always were before. So maybe there's a favor there. So like it could be some statistical probability that's where a branch point could form simply because now you have a cell there doesn't have a favored direction immediately. You see what I mean? They've sort of scrunched up and they like George said, they will have some orientation, but they've kind of retracted everything and now they can have a new choice in life about where
they're. You mean if they're near a branch point?
Well, I was wondering if it wasn't like, I was going to say it a different way. I mean, I'm just, you know, reinterpreting your data, but it's kind of like, let's say you're somewhere along a length segment, and it's time, whether you like it or not, you're going to divide, right? So you do. So you have these two cells here, and they've split their mass, and now they have two separate identities now. And maybe that's a good time, if you're ever going to do it, to go ahead and make a branch point right at that position. You see what I'm saying?
Well, so we don't have big numbers, but that was what we were sort of looking at when we were looking at the sprouts.
Yeah.
You know, we were because there is this model that Keith Mostov has published in MDCK cells, where he says, okay, now you've got the sheet of cells, and it's an epithelial sheet, so most of the divisions are like this to just make the sheet bigger, and then every once in a while you pop a division this way,
right.
and the, one of the daughter cells leaves the sheet, as it were, and starts making a sprout. So we actually love that idea. And if, you know, and again, we don't have high numbers, so maybe when we look at more and with better tools, that will fall out. But at least the few we looked at, within the sprout itself, I mean, you know, prior to sprout formation, it doesn't look like it's an instigator. It looks like, it looks like endothelial cells are followers in terms of, you know, something else is making a sprout. And then the divisions go along. We are very interested in what happens at junctions, and I didn't mention this, but we've, so a junction is a more, presumably more stable structure. It's still got multiple axes, but you know, it could have formed a long time ago. It isn't newly forming. And we deliberately excluded anything that looked like it was too close to a junction or definitely in a junction, because we wanted to have a clear long axis that we could measure to. But we want to go back and actually specifically ask, okay, if you're in a junction and you have a choice, you know, what is your relationship to those different axes as you're dividing, and is there something going on there?
Something kind of off the wall that popped in my head as you were talking about this was, from what I understand, during cell division, there is secretion of proteases. And if the one thing that's never really mentioned that much is the Waseda, the matrix that they're on is degraded locally. That would then provide a direction at the at that cell division point for them to then move off. And so that would be one point. And then the other one is a more general comment to the whole group of people that are working angiogenesis and modeling. And that is to start to think about how you put in pressure. Where is the blood? We all talked about, you know, there's no lumen, or there's a lumen, there's nothing in it, but it's fine. And it all looks good. But when you start to then have a blood pressure and then a sprout and then some even small pressure behind that, driving maybe the chemosensitization in a culture dish, and also then in models, where you now build in, you know, data. So at some point, you know, the whole field, you know, this, we had this 2 weeks ago, we had microfluidics here up the Wazoo. These guys are incredible what they can do. And, you know, to couple microfluidics into cell culture where you're making these tubes, and as soon as the tube forms, you put a little bit of pressure, fluid in it, would be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a great idea. That's a great idea. And again, I think that's why these meetings are great, because obviously, you know, everybody's coming from a different perspective. So
well, one thing with this whole, you know, long period workshop we might bring up when we write our report, I guess, is try and connect the angiogenesis people with the microfluidic people. You know, and even though you weren't here at the same time, we were. And we can kind of, I can see a connection, didn't we?
So, but I do want to make the point that, you know, what we were amazed at was that we saw this regulation without there being at least a strong flow vector. Because I think anybody would say, oh yeah, you know, if you're in a big artery and you've got, you know, 12 dynes per centimeter squared of flow going across an endothelial cell, you know, this is the way you're going to go, right? And so what we're doing is we're looking at something that's independent of that. I mean,
sure. And Dean said that a lot of cells produce these networks. Not
yeah, right, absolutely. MGCK?
Yeah,
I mean,
so,
that's a kidney.
So, no, like you said, there's a randomization which is now being organized. But when you add the flow in, what that would be the true modeling. And I'll just bring up a name, Adrian Bajan. You won't see him, he's down the road at Duke if you can get a passport to get across the border. And he has a constructal theory where he talks about the flow is, it's the easiness of the flow develops the network. So the network develops as the flow gets easier, and it's this, you know, so that there's, he's very interesting, this guy. I mean, he's got a book on structure and nature, whether it's, you know, trees, rivers, I mean, anything. But the matrix is now part of that problem, because this is the material.
it's probably lower than the sprouting frequency. I mean, that's actually a really good question, and we could go back and try to look at that, because we had, you know, independently, we had worked out parameters for quantitating the frequency of sprout initiation. So we could do that, but, you know, there's so few that are actually going like this. And again, it was one of those things where the model was really compelling, but so far our data suggests that what I think happens is I think that there's another signal that initiates the movement of a cell away from the epithelial sheet to start progressing towards something to make a sprout. And then once that happens,
And why is it sort of periodic?
Oh, that's the big question in patterning these days. I mean, that's what people really want to understand, is what regulates that whole process. And I mean, what we know, I mean, I'm sure maybe other people know more that isn't published, but what we know is basically just anecdotal. You know, if you have a sprout that forms, unless you're screwed up genetically, you don't have another sprout immediately right next to it. You do have some sort of spacing. So there's probably some sort of feedback inhibition. And there's a lot of theories out there about how that could be happening. Oh, I wish it did, but at the moment, I don't think so.
Are the lumens permeable to macromolecular components?
That's a good question, and we're actually probably going to do some experiments to try that out. I actually was trying to microinject into the endothelial cells, and I couldn't do that, but I could get into the lumens and I was just doing it with the dye to see, you know, what I was hitting. So now we can go back and we're actually for another project, we're very interested in permeability and how permeability is developed during development, because I don't know how much is known about that. So that's good.
Comment or ask, this may sound strange, any possibility the cells at the back are actually pushing the cells at the front? In other words, I'd have to tell you more about it. I mean, that's possible that there's sort of like gaps that as the sprouts moving forward, there are, like, if they fill in space behind, that it might actually be like a signal that helps from the back through just connectivity of the endos.
Yeah.
Maybe they can push them forward somehow.
Yeah.
By filling in, I don't know how that would work exactly.
Well, when a cell divides, it doesn't spontaneously become two. I mean, there's a mass and it divides, and then that's what there is, and then they could grow hypertrophy, right? So if it would be anything that would be pushing, it would be the hypertrophy.
I'm just wondering if the physical space that the tube is in, there's a space that they're in,
mm-hmm.
and if the cells have to change their shape, if the space doesn't change, but you increase the number of cells
mm-hmm.
in that defined space,
oh, I see.
Could that be a signal to drive the sprout forward
yeah.
from the
mm-hmm.
back?
Yeah, I suppose
it sounds a little bit odd, but
yeah.
Well, what I think is I think the signal to drive the increase rate of cell division is probably the loosening of the junctions that occurs when the cells start out. But that doesn't preclude that there's also a feedback mechanism, right, that would then say, okay, now the cells that are dividing are subsequently pushing forward that sprout. I mean,
what if instead of your confined space, what if we said it a different way? What if we said that it's the same idea, but cells are happy on things that are sort of collinear and under certain tension, and so there's some coarseness in the matrix, and so in its infinite wisdom, nature has set it up so that every once in a while there's a little discontinuity, and that's a favored place to go because it's a stiff body. I mean, it's not a physical. It's not like a tube. You can't go. It's a tunnel. You have to stay inside the tunnel, but it's a favored path, and it's because there's just a little sprout of fibronectin or a little clump of our favorite flavors of matrix.
But that would get it partway, but would it get it all the way down the road?
I think once there's persistence, if you design
mm-hmm.
persistence into your system,
mm-hmm.
if the rule for your cell is that once you start in a direction until you go to another one of these coarse nodes or somebody tells you otherwise, you keep moving in that direction. And let me tell you something, we can put in this stuff that's hemopexin, and you put hemopexin, so this is something that prevents integrins binding the MNPs, okay, real briefly. And if you put that into a direct, the cells move, they change from persistent migration to a random walk by taking the integrin away from the MNP. They don't stop moving, their velocity doesn't stop, they just don't have as much persistence in a certain direction. And all you, so there's a little thermostat there, you know, that says, don't change until something we tell you to do so.
Or makes it easier for you to change. And that will be the constructive here.